Hello and welcome to the Technology Podcast Series by ThoughtWorks. Joining us today, we have Sriram Narayan, Principal Consultant for ThoughtWorks Technologies. Hello, Sriram. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gautam.
You mentioned that you'd be talking about anti-patterns of agile software development. So what do you mean by anti-patterns?
That's just a jargon for saying it's a common mistake. You know, we are used to coming up with best practices for everything, but it's sometimes also useful to identify common mistakes so that we can watch out for them in future.
Okay. Well, why not focus on the right way of doing things instead of looking at the mistakes?
It's just a different way of slicing the situation. Agile software development methods aren't prescriptive by nature, and that is a good thing. But that also means that there is a lot of room for interpretation, and you often have the unfortunate side effect of misconceptions. So I think it's useful to call out these misconceptions that I have experienced and explain why it is so. And hopefully, through the course of explanation, the right way of doing things becomes somewhat self-evident.
So, can you quickly summarize the anti-patterns you're going to talk about today?
I'm going to talk about when agile estimation becomes pointless, labeling people instead of activities, cost-ineffective pair programming, and how to do XYZ in agile. Let's talk about estimation. If a team has to deliver a certain amount of functionality by a certain date, then the act of estimation essentially becomes an act of commitment because there are no levers left. You know, usually the levers on a project are cost, schedule, quality and scope, of which scope is only the real lever that you have. Cost and schedule are often not negotiable, and you don't want to compromise on quality. So if you don't have any levers left, then a metric like velocity no longer remains just a measurement. It becomes a target. And if you have a target velocity on a project, then points-based estimation is just a charade.
True.
The team is better off estimating in real days in this case because it helps the cause of commitment. Points-based estimation is useful when you agree to the following. Plan the story list for a release with only about, say, 70% must-have functionality and the rest is negotiable. This implies that it is potentially okay to go to release into production with just that 70% functionality. The other thing to appreciate is that estimations by definition are approximations, and software estimates are even more so. And so it is counterproductive to insist that your team deliver X points of functionality by day Y. Scope negotiation does not mean that you only change P for Q. Sometimes the X needs to become X plus or minus Y. And that means that you might end up delivering less functionality than was originally thought possible in that time frame with that size of team.
But wouldn't that be like a ripoff?
This is not a rip-off. It doesn't make sense for your IT vendor or your team to rip you off because they can only do so once and they'll lose their reputation over a period of time. And the cost of new business development is very high. And so if you're not going to give them repeat business, they're not going to be competitive for long. So over a longer period of time, appreciating points-based estimation and appreciating the flexibility it gives in terms of choosing how much functionality to fit into an iteration or a release is actually beneficial. We talk about embrace change when we talk about extreme programming, but it's a two-way street. IT delivery team should embrace changes to requirements and priorities from clients, but clients should also embrace change to scope when delivery work proceeds at a different pace than originally expected.
Okay, so what's your take on labeling people instead of activities?
Ideally, an XP team consists of all talented and experienced people. Every person is assumed to have good communication skills, technical skills, ability to analyze, synthesize, understand business drivers, ability to make trade-offs based on business constraints, and the ability to work as part of a team. But you know that we don't have so many people in the market who can do all these things. There are thousands of people probably, but they are scattered all over the world in different pockets of IT, in different enterprises. So the demand for these kind of people outstrips supply by a factor of 100, if not more. Therefore, IT vendors who practice XP, agile methods, are forced to move away from the ideal of more or less homogeneous, poly-skilled teams and settle for some degree of specialization. So we hire people who have a subset of the above skills and assign them to specific roles like developer, analyst, QA, and so on. But it's essential to recognize that this arrangement is a departure from the ideal. It is a compromise driven by market reality. How we look at these roles depends on our model of the ideal world. If you agree with the XP ideal, then roles are labels attached to the activities on a project. For example, a performance tuning activity might need a developer. An activity of scope negotiation might need somebody playing the role of manager. But all too often, we lose sight of the ideal and think of roles as labels attached to the people on a project. So person A is a manager, and it means anything she says outside her labeled area of competency should be taken with a pinch of salt. Same for a developer. Anything non-technical that she says is not considered worth listening to. We forget that the labeled area of competency is merely a mutual agreement at the time of recruitment. We end up discounting the credibility of people outside their labeled domains. This kind of thinking also magnifies capacity constraints in a team. Say we have 4 people with label QA and 12 people with label developer on a team. What happens when stories start piling up in QA? We are less likely to see if some developers can temporarily add capacity to QA. Oh no, that would never do. Developers can't test. They are not wired to test. Mass stereotyping sets in. Soon, people start buying into their labels. Developers refuse to test. If you can communicate well, you are considered suspect as a developer. Managers shy away from writing code or gaining even basic user-level technical competence. They go about saying, "I can't handle technology," as if it were a feather in their cap. We become more and more entrenched in the silos created by our labels. Truly poly-skilled people get disheartened in the process. A person with a label of analyst may have a great aptitude for domain modeling, but her inputs may be sidelined by developers. After a while, she either starts believing in her artificial limitations or starts looking for a job where her skills are more broadly appreciated. It's no good to call everyone consultant and then use a different labeling scheme when it comes to staffing projects. To the extent of their skills, people should get to play multiple roles within a single project. Oh, that complicates staffing. So, should the tail wag the dog? All I'm trying to say is, let people play multiple roles within a single project to the extent of their skills and organize your staffing procedures in such a way that can make this happen. Next, I'd like to talk about pair programming and how its efficacy is generally evaluated.
Sure.
For a project that runs for, say, 6 months or more, there should be no extra development cost on account of pair programming, period. If there is extra cost, it means pairing is not paying off for you. Pairing pays off in a lot of difficult to measure ways. For example, less rework during development on account of misunderstood or ill-defined requirements. These kind of things surface quickly when pairs talk to each other. A slight reduction in maintenance cost on account of clearer code, because every line is now considered readable by at least 2 people. More in case of pair rotation. Third, a better detail level design results when each pair acts as a sounding board for the other. Good design reduces the cost of future change. Pairing is definitely a faster, better process of bringing new team members up to speed. There is lesser impact of people taking vacations. There are less bugs in QA and UAT. People put in more hours of focused work per day. I mean, however professional someone might be, it is natural for concentration to wax and wane. Pairing almost always helps in this aspect. And unlike the case of no pairing, there is no separate code review activity required, so there are some savings on that front. So how do you figure if there is extra cost? Well, you could try to estimate both ways. The total release lifecycle cost for the case of pairing should not exceed that of no pairing. Individual stories might indicate greater cost, but that's okay. It's very difficult to do controlled experiments to nail this down, and there are some studies out there, but your mileage might vary. A word of caution when estimating for such comparisons. Remember that on all real projects, actuals mostly exceed estimates. Some of the difference is borne by the client in terms of change control, etc. and the rest by the vendor or employees based on whether overtime is paid for or not. So you need to have a realistic idea of the effort overrun for the case of no pairing to be able to compare it with the overrun for the case of pairing. If pairing is resulting in net higher development cost on a long-running project, then it simply means, to paraphrase Ken Beck, that the client is getting XP'd on.
That's an interesting take on evaluating pairing. So I guess we have the last anti-pattern coming up now.
Yes, and I call this as how to do XYZ in Agile. You know, clients sometimes ask, how do you do estimation in Agile? Or how do you do some other XYZ in Agile? And typically, these are people making a transition from non-Agile methods. They often want to hold on to some existing ways of functioning. They would like to blend Agile into their existing processes. There is a problem here. To be Agile is not about following a different set of prescribed processes or practices. The only things that matter are continuous delivery of valuable functionality and a happy team. Team here includes client. This is important to recognize. People often think of the client as separate from the team, but true Agile software development can only work when the client members are equal parts of the team.
Very true.
The Agile manifesto starts off by saying, we are uncovering better ways of developing software by doing it and by helping others do it. So the important phrase here is by doing it. And therefore, the practices codified under XP or Scrum is just documentation of how a bunch of practitioners were able to achieve continuous delivery and happy team. The question, how do you do XYZ in Agile, misses the point. It is a relic of what I call process conformance mentality. I was once asked, is it okay to ask for a number of tailorings or deviations from the master process template for Agile? I was speechless. It turns out that this organization still retained the services of a group called SEPG, Software Engineering Process Group. This itself is a relic of CMM. And this group used to define a master process template for Agile. And every project was supposed to conform to the template and ask for approval for trailerings, which means tweaking a process or a practice, or deviations, which is omitting a process or a practice. This is clearly trying to retrofit Agile into your current way of doing things and is not likely to yield the benefits that you're looking for. I mean, after all, I think this is a case where ends justify means. If you're achieving continuous delivery and happy team, you're obviously doing something right. It doesn't matter how Agile it is. If you aren't achieving continuous delivery and happy team, then again, it doesn't matter how Agile your processes are. One might argue that this is watered down Agile. Big deal. It is foolish or even arrogant to assume that we are smarter than the book before we begin. After all, the book represents distilled wisdom of practitioners. But it is important to keep an eye on the outcome. All advice is contextual. It is no use wailing that you have done everything by the book and not getting results. It is dogma to stick to the book in the face of contrary results.
Thank you, Sriram. That was a very informative session on anti-patterns of Agile.
Thank you, Gautam.
And thank you for listening to this podcast. To download more of such podcasts, please visit offshore.thoughtworks.com.